Ladies and gentlemen, today I'm going to address the current state of Iraq and its future. First and foremost, I'm just going to jump in. We have to acknowledge the devastating impact that the Iraq war has had on the country. The costs of the war, both financial and human, have been tremendous. The country's immense oil resources and human capital have been diverted into corruption and patronage politics, leaving its people without basic necessities like electricity, water, healthcare, and education. The fight against the Islamic State subjected the Iraqi people to yet more war and violence, and although the coalition was successful in beating back Daesh, the political imperative of a functioning and responsive government remains unmet. The painful reality for Iraqis and Americans like me who were involved in the Iraq War is that Iraq's new ethno-sectarian political system has made sectarian identity central to Iraqi politics. The domino effect in the region has also been the opposite of what the US hoped for. The bloodshed and waves of recurring violence have made Iraq a cautionary tale that regimes could use to undermine the democratic desires of their own populations. What good can democracy bring if it only leads to chaos? We hear this more and more now. Perhaps one gain that Iraqis could take solace in after 2003 is the ability to freely choose their leaders. You could argue that's a right that they had never enjoyed since the formation of the modern Iraqi state. But the 20 years of this ethno-sectarian political system known as Mohasasa has created a private club of elites that not even a popular uprising by Iraqi
muted
youth in 2019 could break into. And just to review, in late 2019, Iraq's young population exploded in frustration, protesting against the lack of progress and reforms. And unfortunately, these protests were met with violence from Iranian-backed militias. And there was some evidence that it was, you know, they brought in actually Iranian security forces themselves who have gained a very strong foothold in the security service, as well as some of the Iraqi Shia political parties. High abstention rates in the last two elections also indicate Iraqis' alarming disillusionment with the democratic experiment. So, you know, the electoral system, despite reforms that they're likely about to be reversed, the reforms, even while they've been in place, have failed to convince the non-politicized, non-sectarian voters to cast their ballot. So in the last parliamentary elections in 2021, only 44% of those eligible to vote did so. The difficult year that it took Iraq's politicians to form a government after the elections almost brought the country to its knees. If anything, that only proves how disconnected the political class is from the needs of the public. This is a dynamic that I don't believe will change anytime soon. The fact is that oil, black gold, played and continues to play a definitive role in shaping Iraq's economy, of course. In 2003, when US soldiers left every government institution in Baghdad and made them an easy target for looters, they stood guard outside the Ministry of Oil. That year, Iraq only made $8 billion in oil revenues. Last year, it made around $116 billion. Throughout these last 20 years, the Iraqi government they estimate $1.17 trillion in oil revenues enter its coffers, but Iraqis saw little in return. Barham Saleh, the former president of Iraq, estimates that Iraq lost nearly 13% of that total to theft, which, you know, in and of itself is a huge number. But we also ask, where did the rest of the money go? Electricity in Iraq still unreliable in 2023, like it was during the era of sanctions back in the 1990s. And the rest of the country's infrastructure and public services are lacking and dilapidated despite years of Iraqi government spending, in addition to U.S. and international aid. As for grabbing Iraq's oil, former President Donald Trump was right. The victor, after all, did not grab the spoils. ExxonMobil entered the country in 2009, and after years of, you know, complaining about the tight terms offered by the Iraqi government, ExxonMobil is now in the process of exiting Iraq. Meanwhile, Chinese firms are steadily expanding their footprint in Iraq's oil industry. As the Sunni-Shia sectarian tensions have escalated, Iran's increasing influence over a major Arab country with enormous oil reserves on Saudi Arabia's northern border has been unsettling for much of the region. The Saudis and other Gulf monarchies, as well as Israel, have been dismayed by Iran's support of proxies and partners outside of Iraq, such as the Houthi militia in Yemen, that brought violence right to the Saudi doorstep, actually inside of Saudi Arabia. So despite the shared Arab identity of Iraq and its Gulf neighbors, these neighbors have all but forfeited the competition for influence to Iran. And if you're interested, please ask me a question about this, because I have a lot more to say. While Saudi Arabia has provided significant financial assistance to Iraq over the years, its relationship with its neighbor remains complex and is shaped by a range of political and strategic factors. In 2017, the kingdom pledged $1.5 billion in assistance to Iraq to help it rebuild after the defeat of ISIS. This aid was focused on areas such as water supply, electricity, health, education, and transport infrastructure. In addition, the Saudi Development Fund has provided loans to Iraq to finance various development projects. Despite these efforts, the relations between the two countries remain strained. Saudi Arabia has been concerned about the growing influence of Iran in Iraq and the potential for this to undermine Saudi interests in the region. And in fact, I would argue it is part of the Saudi calculus to go to the negotiating table with Iran, as we saw recently with their joint statement coming from Beijing. This has increased tremendously the pressure on Saudi Arabia and has resulted in, because they lost the partnership of the United States in this endeavor, they felt forced to speak with Iran in a way that they likely never would have. The recently announced Moroccan-Iraqi rapprochement is a step in the right direction, as Morocco is joining other Arab countries and trying to mitigate Iran's influence in Iraq. I feel confident saying this never would have happened without the Abraham Accords and Morocco's formally recognizing Israel and opening diplomatic relations and economic partnerships. You know, some think that we can expect more announcements on bilateral trade, diplomatic and security agreements between Iraq and other countries of the Arab League. I would just say time will tell. I'm not as convinced. So to complicate matters even more, the situation in Iraqi Kurdistan is particularly delicate. The Biden administration has been encouraging the sale of oil from Iraqi Kurds to Turkey, citing U.S. efforts to isolate Russia and Iran. While this might seem like a good idea on the surface, there are several problems with this approach. The logic that trans-Turkey pipelines somehow would sideline Russia and Iran makes no sense. Azerbaijan, which ships oil across Turkey for export, openly participates in gas swaps with Iran to make up for its shortfalls. Turkey, meanwhile, has become a money laundering center for Russia. I would just say I know there. I've seen reporting and I've read a lot of things about U.S. government, like non-elected U.S. government officials traveling to Erbil to try to convince Iraqi Kurds to make some deals. I Iraqi Kurds to be very careful as they move forward and avoid any dealings which would enrich and empower President Erdogan, because I think this current Congress is actually discussing potential sanctions against Turkey. So that could put the Kurds in a very bad situation. Congress does not approve of empowering Turkey. And thankfully, many in Congress prefer to focus on future investment in Israeli, Cypriot, and Greek gas, which really is where the future is. So speaking of Israel, there have been reports that Israel is providing military and intelligence support and has done for a long time to Kurdish forces in fighting against ISIS. There have also been reports of economic and energy ties between Israel and the Kurdish regional government, with some Israeli companies reportedly operating in Iraqi Kurdistan. I don't know about you, I hope that's the case. They can use all the help they can get. So while the situation in Iraq has improved in some ways, particularly in the fight against ISIS, the country still faces huge challenges. The political situation in Iraq remains unstable, with corruption and patronage politics diverting resources away from much needed services for the people. To conclude, I'll just say, as the situation in Iraq continues to evolve, it's important to take a nuanced approach because there are so many different factors in play. We have to be mindful of the challenges the country is facing. We should work to support its people, but there are a lot of existing tensions that we should try to avoid inflaming. So it won't be easy, but I think we can, keep encouraging a working together for a more stable and prosperous future for Iraq, and an Iraq that is not completely beholden to Iran and is not an Iranian satellite like Lebanon. I don't think Iraq is at the level of Lebanon at this time, but I think without careful attention and a lot of influence from other countries, I think it is trending in that way. So I look forward to the conversation and appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all today.
Great. Thank you, Simone, for that comprehensive analysis. There's a lot to talk about, and obviously you've touched on a lot of points. So the floor is now open for questions. So please type in your questions via the chat. In the meantime, Alex, I'll let you start us off with the first question.
Sure. Thanks very much for the summary of where we're at. I have a lot of questions. I think the most interesting, the most important area has to do with China. And China, as part of the Belt and Road Initiative, has invested, if reports are to be believed, $10.5 billion in infrastructure development in Iraq, including power plants and schools and other a variety of sorts of things. It's the third largest recipient of Belt and Road investment. And as everyone knows, Belt and Road investment is really for its own Chinese benefit. But I'm wondering how the U.S. Views this and how the U.S. is supposed to compete with this Apparently, U.S. companies have signed about $8 billion worth of contracts with in a recent memorandum of understanding with Iraqi the Iraqi government, but that's not the same as pouring $10.5 billion into development. So is this, where do we stand? Where do we go with these kinds of realities?
Well, thank you for your question. I think there's a number of things to say. So yes, Iraq is a recipient, joined the Belt Road Initiative and is a recipient of significant Chinese aid. I think we can see, we can look at other countries who are further along the path on the Belt Road Initiative and see that they've been, in some cases, economically decimated and basically had to turn over the keys to the kingdom to China because they're unable to pay back their debt. It's, you know, the Belt Road Initiative is a debt trap that the deeply corrupt government of Iraq, I think the individuals involved benefited significantly personally from that deal. But when you look at, you know, more broadly, China's goals in the region, China is moving very quickly to supplant the U.S. as the kind of key partner of choice for a lot of our traditional partners in the Middle East. And they're doing that through also a lot of energy deals. You know, the largest, you know, the largest purchaser of Middle East oil is China, because they need so much energy and they don't, you know, they don't have any internally. So they're, from a U.S. perspective, we've made so many really important strategic errors. And I think one of the biggest ones has been to say, well, we're focusing on China in, you know, the Indo-PACOM region. So in the East is where we're focused on China. But we could be focused on China in the Middle East, which the Middle East is such an important partner for China, and therefore it should be an important partner for us, even in the context of a potential future conflict with China, or even in our current state of competition. I think, you know, my personal opinion, we should be imposing costs and making these partnerships difficult, and at minimum speaking out against them. But the current administration has actually been, I think, congratulating all the parties involved and encouraging this type of activity, which we'll really regret, I think, in due course and not too far distant future, unfortunately.
Great, thank you for that. Let me just go to the audience here, Alex, and we'll come back to you if that's okay.
Sure, please.
Our friend Lise Corson has a few questions here. Let me try to consolidate some of them. But if you could just go into why Saudi Arabia and the Gulf forfeited their influence when it comes to Iraq, in Iraq to Iran, and kind of go into, you know, a little bit, you know, into that aspect, as far as maybe you want to touch also, and I'm just adding here, the recent brokered Chinese deal between the Iranians and the Saudis, you know, how that impacts how this relates to Iraq as well.
So if you want to go back to 2003, the Saudis and really the majority, I think all of the Gulf countries, either publicly or privately, opposed the U.S. And at the time, actually, it was a coalition invasion of Iraq, and were really, really unhappy when we ignored them. I think hindsight being 2020, we were very focused on the decision makers were, I was in my 20s at the time, were very focused on removing Saddam Hussein without necessarily considering the second and third order effects, which really have played out to be the rise of Iran in the region. Iran getting access to Iraqi oil revenue, it's been a game changer for them. And it was especially during the Trump years when they were really suffering under sanctions. So I think from the beginning, the Saudis were very, they were angry with us and sort of didn't want to get involved because they disagreed with the principle of an American invasion of Iraq. So I think it took several years for that to wear off. But they've really hesitated to get involved for many years because of this unhappiness and feeling of not being respected or listened to. They also, I think from an earlier time, I don't think they could have imagined that Iran would gain the foothold that it has. I think 2011 was a real game changer in terms of Iranian influence in Iraq. I think we had done a pretty good job of shoring up Iraqi support for the U.S. and for the West until the withdrawal in 2011, when Iranian supported leaders in the military and in the Iraqi government removed a lot of the kind of pro-American, pro-West leaders that had been in place that we had, trained, we had equipped. They were either killed or moved out and replaced with, Iranian followers, who are still in place today. A lot of the, a lot of people don't realize, a lot of these Iran-backed militias, Shia militias that still exist outside of the formal command structure of the Iraqi military and security forces, those are actually paid by the Iraqi government from, Iraqi oil funds. And so that's limited, for example, the U.S. and Saudi, we don't want to pay for that. So just giving the Iraqi government aid, especially when you consider how much they make from their oil revenue, they just, it's just through corruption, they lose a lot of it. So any aid that we were to give or the Saudis were to give would actually ultimately partially pay for the continuation of these things that are really counter to our goals and our own national security concerns. So that's another important reason why they've been hesitant to support things and why the things that they support today are really based on humanitarian a humanitarian response rather than anything security related. And then you wanted to know about the current agreement between Iran and Russia and China. I mean, Iran and Saudi Arabia. I skipped ahead. Iran and Saudi Arabia. Yeah, it is a very strong signal. I think I, like a lot of people, will just wait and see. I don't think they're going to become best friends. But I think it was such an important message to the United States that just fell on deaf ears with our current government that, if you're not going to help protect us, we're going to do what we have to do. This is from the Saudi perspective, of course. We're going to do what we have to do to protect ourselves. And we have to make these, very distasteful deals that are, we would never have considered before, but the current situation requires it. That's where they find themselves today. And so they have to make new partnerships. It's very uncomfortable for us, but we have to understand why that's the case.
Great. Thank you for that. Next question, a little bit more about U.S.-Kurdish relations. What's really, as far as the approach to U.S. taking when it comes to Iraq, and maybe you want to kind of expand a little bit about, again, general U.S. policies when it comes to state building, nation building, and kind of what we've done and where we're going forward in that regard.
With respect to the Kurds?
Yeah, policy in general.
Well, you know, specific to the Kurds, they've been great partners to the U.S. over the years, many decades. And obviously they became excellent smugglers during the 90s and the oil for food era. You know, excellent, really world-class black market smugglers, because that's how they survive. And if you've ever been in Iraq, you can compare kind of the northern Iraqi Kurdish area to, you know, the southern kind of more a traditional, like, non-Kurdish Iraq. It's incredibly different. It seems it's much more tolerant in the Kurdish area, and that area never really experienced the privations that the rest of the country did during oil for food because of their success at black market smuggling. But you know, the situation changed for them dramatically with the advent of ISIS and the mass murder of the Iraqi Kurds, and obviously they're struggling in Syria, Turkey. They've been declared a terrorist group, so at least the PKK has, for good reason. So they've been struggling now for a very long time. The U.S. Has used the Kurds many different times, has benefited greatly from our partnership with the Kurds, and has a very sad history of abandoning them when we don't need them anymore. That certainly, you know, happened once again during the Trump administration, happened, I think every administration at one point has abandoned the Kurds, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, it's still in their best interest to partner with us, even if we do prove to be unreliable partners. It's not like they have a lot of other options, unfortunately for them. So, and fortunately for us, because at the end of the day, they're excellent partners that, have been extremely helpful for us to achieve our own strategic ends. So it's, you know, they're in a tough position, and I don't really think that's going to change. With respect to their relationship with the broader Iraqi government, it's much less tense now than it used to be. But they have these ongoing struggles with, for example, some of the oil revenue does come from Iraqi Kurdistan, but the Iraqi government is obligated to pay, like, the KRG, the Kurdish regional government's budget, from the national oil revenue. And there's been this ongoing dispute now for a number of years about, like, basically the Iraqi government doesn't pay. So when I was in the Defense Department, for example, we were paying for the Peshmerga, for the, you know, Kurdish army's weapons and different equipment, because they were supposed to be getting it from the Iraqi government, but they weren't. So that's all to say, it's complicated, and there's really no good answer. Unfortunately, we're just kind of lurching along, and I hope the Kurds deserve, you know, better, more stable partners, but I think this is all they're going to get from the U.S. This is the best they can hope for, unfortunately, for the foreseeable future. And then there was another question. I'm sorry, I forgot it.
No, that's fine. You tackled it as you were talking about that. Okay. So next question, just, you know, the topic you did not address, you know, in your remarks, I hear a little bit about that. So the connection between Iraq and the Israelis, I mean, you know, especially, you know, there's obviously two schools of thought militarily wise, as far as Israel as it relates to Iran, as far as, you know, militarily using Saudi airspace, but obviously Iraqi airspace and the entire Israeli apparatus these days when it comes to, precision guided missiles and, you know, using Iraq as a buffer zone with the United States. Can you comment a little bit about that and talk about, you know, how this relates to Israel and Iraq? And obviously the Israeli intel when it came to Iraq, you know, in the United States 20 years ago, maybe you want to comment there.
Yeah, sorry about my dog. Yeah, good boy.
Scared him off with the Israelis, I know.
So currently, I think as we all know, Iraq and Israel don't have official diplomatic relations. And any contact between the two countries at this time is really limited. There's obviously a long history of conflict and hostility between the two countries that goes back to 48, and obviously the subsequent Arab boycott of Israel. So there have been some recent indications that the situation could be shifting. So like back in August of 2020, Bibi at the time was saying that, you know, they were talking to many Arab countries, including Iraq. He said, including Iraq, about establishing official relations. So then I saw there was reporting about a secret meeting between Iraqi officials and the then energy minister Steinitz back in October of 2020, which was really focused on energy cooperation. Those are significant developments. Even if they ultimately didn't lead to anything at the time, it just shows kind of a growing recognition among at least some Iraqi officials that closer ties with Israel could be beneficial for them. Israel obviously is a leader in so many areas, technology, water management, security, obviously. Iraq really could benefit from closer cooperation in these fields. And, you know, ultimately, Iran is not helping Iraq to grow. It's a leech. It's sucking everything out of Iraq. It's not the younger generation of Iraqis don't, you know, you don't look at Lebanon and think, wow, I want to be like that. I mean, that's not where they want to go. So Israel is seen as an important counterweight to Iran and Iranian influence. But I have to say any movement toward a closer relationship with Israel would likely face significant opposition within Iraq. I mean, it's known that there was a thriving Jewish community in Iraq for you know, centuries. But there's nothing left. You know, there's nothing left there. Memories like the generation who remembered the Jewish community of 48 and before, they're all, you know, dead or dying now. So, and there are a lot of hardline factions that just view Israel as the enemy. So progress toward an official diplomatic relationship, I see that as being very slow and incremental, kind of cautious steps taken, but nothing significant, because that probably would cause mass, you know, inflamed tensions within Iraq. But I think the cautious interest, tentative exploration, this is all good news. It's potential progress. So never say never. This is what we've learned, that at least, right? Never say never.
Great. Thank you for that. Alex, going back to you.
Sure. Since we're going sort of around the horn a little bit in terms of Iraqi relations with other states and the U.S., the implications, let's say, for the U.S., what about Syria? And it's sort of a timely moment to talk about this. The U.S. House just voted down a resolution that would withdraw the 900 U.S. troops that are still stationed in Syria, and it's about to vote on revoking the two authorization of military force resolutions that had put American forces in Iraq in the first place 20 years ago, and which had been used as the justification for a variety of interventions. And you know, as the UAE in particular is beginning to has begun to hedge its position with the U.S., with Iran, with the Saudis, and is now trying to bring the al-Assad regime back into the fold, particularly after the tragic earthquake. Where does the U.S. fit into all this? What is the official U.S. view of rehabilitating the al-Assad regime, and particularly after all of the investments in Iraq and now in Syria?
Well, you're talking to someone who is in favor of removing the rest of our troops from Syria. I think that the argument for keeping our troops in Syria is really to help Israel. I think at the end of the day, we are conducting counterterrorism operations. We continue to conduct counterterrorism operations in Syria. While Daesh does not have, they don't have, you know, land anymore. They don't have their Islamic caliphate. They still exist. And actually we have these massive prison camps, and they call them refugee camps, but they're primarily ISIS families, you know, wives and children who have now been there a significant period of time and are, I mean, read the articles that come from the people who visited, like Al-Hol. This is the creation of the next generation of terrorists. And, you know, I my personal belief is we're going to have to go back. And not just us, you know, the world will be threatened by ISIS again, or some, you know, whatever the new group that comes from what ISIS was will call itself. I mean, it's not done. This conflict will continue past a year in my lifetime for sure, unfortunately. But the current challenge is not really from ISIS, although we're still, you know, cutting off whoever the new leader of the week is. We're targeting them, and we're very good at that. But the real issue is Hezbollah and Quds Force, who are operating in Syria, and they continue to operate freely with the support and protection of the Syrian government and the Russian government. And obviously this poses a direct threat to our very close partner, Israel. That's why we're there today. And we talk about ISIS, and I think it's not a false justification, but when you look at the legal, we're there under the AUMF for counterterrorism, but the real strategic reason we're there it's not really that, in my opinion. And so I think we should be considering new authorities in 2023. I think it's time. I think it's just. And so I hope that, I know a lot of people are afraid because it removes a lot of power from the executive and brings it back to Congress. And I think at this time it is appropriate. These are discussions that we should be having as a country, it should not just be, you know, the executive who decides all of these things, because there's a lot of debate in the country. And I think that's, we all have our opinions, and I think that's healthy. So when we send Americans overseas to fight and potentially lose their lives, I think that should be kind of a group decision. So I think that's appropriate. In terms of the rehabilitation of Al-Assad, the UAE has been pushing this for a really long time. They just see an opening right now. We were very aggressively pushing back on them during the Trump administration, but I think now they either care less what the U.S. has to say or they're receiving less pushback. I'm not sure which. But yeah, they're very determined to do this, and they're big supporters of Al-Assad. It's hard to see past the war crimes that Assad has committed, and I don't think we should be looking past them. Grave crimes using chemical weapons against his own people. Someone who does that should never be acknowledged or accepted into the broader kind of polite world, leadership group. And so I think Al-Assad should be shunned forever and should never be accepted back into public life in a way where he'll be representing Syria and other countries. But, UAE, they have their own set of rules that they operate under. People forget post-Abraham Accords. They're not like us in many respects. And it's important to keep that in mind. And I think that their support of Al-Assad really shows that.
Great, thank you for that. Alex, before we go back. So to follow up, Simone, as Alex was saying, as we're kind of going around the horn, as far as country-wise, lessons learned. I mean, obviously, maybe comparing, contrasting between the what happened in Iraq and versus what, Afghanistan, and kind of, talk about that, as far as U.S. policy going forward in general in the region.
Sure. Thanks for that. So I served in both conflicts. So I have some insight into that. I do feel that there were many similarities, but also so many differences. For example, the justification for invading Afghanistan was September 11th. I know right now there's a lot of revisiting the reasons for the Iraq invasion in 2003, and a lot of people who were supporters then and remain supporters today talk about how horrible Saddam Hussein was and how much better things are for Iraqis today because we removed Saddam Hussein. I don't know if an Iranian satellite is better for U.S. and global security than Saddam Hussein was. I think that's open for debate, frankly. But, the conduct of both wars was extremely, quite different. There was Iraq as a country and the Iraqi population are much more sophisticated, much better educated than, most of the Afghans that I know. They have a very low rate of education, and in fact, most Afghans are illiterate. Even the men, not women, are not allowed to go to school anymore, thanks to the Taliban. But there's a dramatic difference between what the Iraqis like, what they're kind of the best they could hope for, and they also have access to, they have this massive oil revenue, whereas Afghans and Afghanistan does not. Their major export is opium, continues to be opium. So, on the face, the kind of desired strategic end state for each country would be dramatically different. But I think some of the same mistakes were made in each conflict. Again, in my opinion, everyone has a different opinion on this, it seems, but this idea that I think you mentioned this at the outset, the idea that we could use the military to bring democracy or to actually impose another way of life on another country. I mean, we did that during World War II, but we didn't do what was needed, I think, in these conflicts. And in fact, with respect to Iraq, by 2011, I think I argued this earlier, I think we had achieved most of our goals, but by just picking up full stop and leaving, we left an opening for Iran, which took it and ran with it. And so it's like others have said this better, but we seized defeat from the jaws of victory, I think, in Iraq. I agree with that assessment. With respect to Afghanistan, there was so much waste, fraud, and abuse. The Taliban actually was extorting money from every link in our supply chain. So when you ask, like, who was funding the Taliban, yeah, they made a lot of money from drug trafficking, from criminal activity, like kidnapping for ransom, stuff like that. But they actually made a lot of money from us and from our contractors and subcontractors. And I think that's a story that has yet to really be told in full. But a lot of our leaders knew about it and didn't really take the actions that they should have in order to fix it. And so it was really a slow bleed over many decades. My last tour there was 2009 to 2010. And at the time, our leadership knew that we had this problem with our logistics network actually being extorted by the Taliban. And it continued for another decade before we pulled out. So many, many mistakes, and that will reverberate, unfortunately, for the United States and for the world for many years to come.
Great. Thank you for that. Alex, you have another question there?
Sure. Well, let me just follow up on that issue of mistakes that were made and how they are going to reverberate and come back to haunt us. And this really changes the focus away from the stated topics of Iraq and the region to America itself and to the government and the political system or environment as we now see it in terms of the stomach for intervention. And as you noted, as you suggest, it will be necessary to go back and deal somebody to go back and deal with ISIS at some point in the future once the pressure has been released. And there are probably lots of different situations like that. Where do you see Americans in the near term, the middle term, having the interest or the ability, given the looming strategic conflict in the Pacific, to be able to do this with respect to the Middle East?
So I'm not sure I fully understand the question, but I'll give it my best shot. So I think that based on a lot of the things that we have done in the last 20 years, and our most kind of recent response, i.e. the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan, where I, just to be clear, I disagreed with where I questioned what we were doing the last 10 years. We were in Afghanistan. The withdrawal was a catastrophe and could have been done in a completely different way, where we also still maintained a small force, which I would argue we absolutely needed and need there. Based on most recent testimony from our current CENTCOM commander, he said within 6 months, ISIS and Afghanistan will have the ability to start attacking targets outside of Afghanistan. So that's pretty quick. So whereas ISIS in Syria is going to take a long time to marinate and develop, I don't think ISIS globally is going to take that long. Unfortunately, we've given them back their training centers and their breeding grounds. That said, yeah, the U.S. is not viewed as a reliable partner. I mean, this has been the case for many years now, but it used to be that when it came to foreign policy, there were certain policies of the United States that really did not change from when you had a Democrat administration or a Republican administration. They were just like truths of, you know, agreed upon truths of American foreign policy. That's just not the case today. And it seems like every time we get a new administration in place, our the way that we see the world and the way that we act with our partners, and even the way we treat, you know, in one administration, a certain set of countries is viewed as a partner, and in the next administration, and a different set of countries is viewed as partners. That was not the case previously. And I think this has startled and upset a lot of our traditional partners who, you know, have gone looking for alternatives. And it's really weakened our position as we look to try to counteract the rise of China and Russia as its kind of smaller satellite. It's, you know, we put ourselves in a very bad position going forward. Look, I know this is very doom and gloom, a lot of what I'm saying. I still believe, like, I would not bet against the United States in the long term, but I think in the short term, it's very choppy. And I hope that we, you know, as we move forward and, you know, have new elections and elect new leaders in different places, I hope that we put people in those jobs who understand how important that that is, and can help lead the United States out of this period of turmoil.
Great. Thank you for everything, Simone. Really, I mean, thank you for the comprehensive analysis and for taking us around the horn of all the, you know, these dynamics and these ever-changing synergies and challenges that we're facing all around. And there's obviously a lot more to talk about, but I appreciate you taking the time this afternoon to talk to us. And I want to thank everybody for joining us this afternoon, as always, and taking the time to join our conversations. As always, I want to thank my colleague and friend, Alex Jaffe. I want to thank you, Simone, again, for joining us, and everybody else for coming to join us here. And, of course, be on the lookout for future webinars that we will be posting in the next few days. So thank you, everybody. Thank you, Simone. And we'll talk. Take care.